Hello, I am Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk. A few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of speaking with Professor Perry Atabar from the UBC Department of Civil Engineering right here in the CITR studio. We discussed the field of structural engineering specifically in the aftermath of the mega earthquake that hit the country of Chile last year. Today, I will continue that discussion with Perry's colleague, Dr. Carlos Ventura. Dr. Ventura is a civil engineer with specializations in structural dynamics and earthquake engineering. He is currently the director of the Earthquake Engineering Research Facility at UBC, and he is also the author of more than 350 papers and reports on earthquake engineering, structural dynamics, and model testing. Dr. Ventura has conducted research on the effects of earthquakes for more than 25 years. His current research is focused on the development of performance-based guidelines for the seismic retrofit of BC schools, as well as the research of new technologies to monitor the health of bridges in this province. But before we begin our discussion together, let's listen to part of a series that showcased some of this research at UBC. It was on the Discovery Channel in a program titled Monster Quake, Will We Survive? Have a listen.
It's a ticking time bomb. The Pacific Northwest coast is due for a monster quake. Thousands will die. Buildings will crumble.
It has a 1 in 10 chance of collapsing due to an earthquake.
Accurately predicting the impact of megaquakes on modern structures has been impossible until now. In Chile, it's just happened. For two terrifying minutes, the earth shakes violently.
Brittle fracture on those guys right there.
Modern buildings collapse.
Finds the absolute weakest point and it comes down.
Investigators want to know why.
The earthquake in Chile is essentially what we're expecting here in the Pacific Northwest. There's so many similarities that, frankly, it's scary.
And the disaster in Chile, with its strict earthquake codes for buildings.
I think if we're going to put up a 50-story building, you'd better stay there.
Calls into question the very safety of some of North America's biggest cities. Pacific Northwest, Seattle, Portland, and Vancouver. Many move here for the scenery. But those towering mountains hint at something ominous, something unavoidable, something so big it could level entire cities and kill tens of thousands in minutes.
We're talking about bridges going out.
Three pillars down.
We're talking about tsunamis.
We got one casualty right here.
We're looking at damage all the way from Vancouver, British Columbia, down to Northern California. These are giant earthquakes lasting several minutes. It will be devastating.
Known as a megaquake, it is one of the most destructive seismic events on Earth. More than 100 times more powerful than the great San Francisco earthquake.
It is definitely a matter of when, not if. The latest research is showing that they occur about every 300 to 350 years, and the last one was about 310 years ago.
Just off the coast of North America, an enormous fault zone runs for more than 600 miles. This is where the Cascadia megaquake will come from. The shaking will last 4 minutes.
Carlos, thank you for joining us today in the CITR studio, and welcome to Prof Talk.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon.
So we just heard a clip from a documentary that you were interviewed on following the earthquake last year in Chile. Maybe as a basic starting point, can you educate us on what really a mega earthquake is?
Well, a mega earthquake is a term that we use to refer to an earthquake that is characterized by a very large magnitude, a magnitude 8 or 9 in the Richter scale. That's what we might call a mega earthquake, and it's just because of the sheer size of that.
Right. Now, how do engineers really define earthquakes? Do you use this term, or is it more, are there other factors at play?
It's more than just the magnitude. The magnitude is just a simple index that is being used for many years to give us a sense of what's the size of the earthquake and the amount of energy that has been generated. But for an engineering point of view, what is more important is the amount of shaking that will be experienced in an area. And that's depending on the epicenter of the earthquake, the type of soil conditions that you have in the area, and the type of earthquake mechanism that is affecting the area. So it's a very complex problem. So from an engineering point of view, we look at more than just the magnitude itself.
Yeah. Right. Now, how are earthquakes generated? What happens within the Earth's crust during an earthquake?
Well, the current theory that explains most of the earthquakes, about 90% of the earthquakes in the world, is called plate tectonics. In ancient times, there were many theories that tried to explain earthquakes, but what we understand today is that Mother Earth is like a broken dish with little pieces that are moving all the time. And these pieces are pushing against each other, and sometimes the stress caused by that pushing and pulling is large enough that causes slip between these little pieces. And when that happens, an earthquake is generated. Mm-hmm. So it could be a large amount of stress that is generated over the years, and then the slip is very, very large. Or it could be just a little knock, and then we will have a small earthquake, like magnitude 3 or 4, or like what happens every day.
Mm-hmm. Which happened yesterday, in fact. We talked about that before the interview. Can you tell us about some of these earthquakes that are continuously happening?
Yeah, like these small earthquakes are happening by the thousands every day, right? Like magnitude 2 and 3, they happen by the thousand in a day. But when you go to the larger earthquakes, like magnitude 8, maybe 1 or 2 a year. So in between, you have the whole variety. And of course, in areas where earthquakes are happening, which are those areas where the broken dishes, the broken plates are interfacing, then you have little earthquakes or large earthquakes happening on a regular basis. Yeah.
So this is called the Richter scale. And so it's enough for us to know how strong an earthquake is. But what other parameters influence the effect of an earthquake?
Well, a big important parameter is the distance. Okay, so the clip that was talking about this monster earthquake, but for us, this earthquake is the fault that is causing that is 100 kilometers away from us, maybe 160 to 200 kilometers from Vancouver. So one thing that helps us a little bit is that we are far away from that distance, but that earthquake, as the clip was showing, is going to last for a long, long time and is going to have a very large effect. But if you start considering other type of earthquakes that we have in the province, probably earthquakes smaller magnitude in the Strait of Georgia or in other faults that are known to be in the region, the earthquakes might be in the Richter scale magnitude 6, 7 or so, which we might consider much lesser than those, but the distance is much closer. So the effect of those earthquakes could be probably more devastating than the big monster quake that everybody talks about. And that's one concern that the engineering community has, that we have to understand what is called earthquake sources and earthquake mechanisms, identify where are those, look at the distance between urban areas, and then try to make predictions of what level of shaking those areas will be experiencing.
So what kind of earthquake can we really expect here in Vancouver?
Good question. Well, we live in a very interesting geological setting, right? So we are talking about these big subduction earthquakes, the monster earthquake, right? That is in the subduction zone, which is offshore Vancouver Island. Then we have other type of earthquakes that are called subcrustal earthquakes that are below the crustal, and the crust. And then we have the crustal earthquakes that are closer to the surface. So we live in a very unique setting in the world because these three types of earthquakes are likely to occur here. And there is historical evidence that those earthquakes have happened in the past. An example of a subcrustal earthquake is perhaps the Nisqually earthquake in Seattle in 2001. That's a sample of that earthquake that usually happens every 30 or 40 years. And it's likely to have an effect on us because we have the possibility of an earthquake of that type. And that was an earthquake in magnitude 6.1. So it's not the big one, but look at the damage that it caused in Seattle. And then we have the crustal earthquakes that are more closer to the surface. Okay, and usually will be magnitude 6, 6.5, or 7. And there is evidence of those in past time in the province. It's just that when those earthquakes happened, the population was just a fraction of what it is today, and the urban environment was not as it is today. So if that earthquake were to happen again today, we'll be seeing a different story.
So what do we know about that earthquake, that mega earthquake that hit Vancouver 311 years ago?
Yeah, well, it's in geological times, the range is between 300 and 500 years, right? But when you look from the geological times point of view, it's nothing, right? That variation is just a percent in time. So in average, we'll say that this earthquake might happen between 300 and 500 years because historical evidence through carbon dating and studies that have done by geoscientists show that earthquake has happened many times in history, right? So that's why, based on history, historical records and geological settings and investigations, we have concluded that earthquake is likely to happen every 300 to 500 years in average, right? So now we are pretty much into the cycle where that earthquake is likely to happen again. Whether we can pinpoint the exact date and time is not possible. Just from pure statistics and knowledge base, we have concluded that earthquake is likely to happen again. But that's as far as we can go, right? And what we really know by a fact is that in areas of the world where earthquake has happened in history, they tend to happen again. But there are also some surprises where there has been 2,000 years and no earthquake has happened, and then an earthquake happened, right? And evidence of that is in Iran, a recent earthquake that happened there that was not predicted for a long, long time. There was a city that nobody expected the earthquake happen. And the earthquake happens, not a large one, but kills 25,000 people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is why this problem is very complicated, and we are learning as we go, pretty much.
I did also ask your colleague Perry about the earthquake in Chile. I also want to ask you the same question. Should we expect an earthquake very similar to the one that happened in Chile last year?
Yes, in a sense, yes, because the geological setting of Chile is somewhat similar to what we have here. It's the interface of two major plates. What we have here, one plate is subducting or trying to push under the other one, and same setting there. It's just that the geological setting in South America is slightly different than what we have here, so we cannot say that the earthquakes is going to be exactly as the one that it happened in Chile, but it's going to be very, very similar, right? And the type of propagation, how the waves propagate from the epicenter location to very long, long distances, that's something that could easily apply to our setting, and those are the important lessons that we learned from Chile. And the fact that now we have seen a large subduction earthquake and see how long it lasts. And also the reference for the Sumatra earthquake in 2004, another very large subduction earthquake that lasted even longer than the one in Chile, right? Because it was much longer. So the one in Sumatra lasted for about 5 to 10 minutes, right, of severe shaking. So we're talking about big things that are going to shake for a long time.
Right. Part of your research is in performance-based design of structures. Now, can you define that for us? And what is the change to the previous approach of design of seismic-resistant structures?
Well, it's pretty much the same, okay? But it's a terminology that we are using now to better understand how to design a building or a structure to resist an earthquake, right? Performance-based essentially means that you try to decide what level of performance you want in your structure to have, right? In the past, we were saying, okay, all the structures will be designed to prevent collapse, Okay. So if you are in a building that has been designed according to the building code, the philosophy is that if you have a large earthquake, the building might have damaged, but you will be able to walk out of the building. Okay. Your life is preserved. And the same way that your house is being designed, right? According to the code, is preservation of life. But in recent, the last 20, 30 years, we have been learning that that's not enough, right? That people pay a significant cost for those earthquakes. And that started with the Northridge earthquake in California, the Loma Prieta earthquake in California in 1989, where the human losses were just of the order of 50, 60 people, but the financial losses for California were in the order of tens of billions of dollars. And then a few years later, in Los Angeles, another earthquake happens, not a large magnitude, but significant size, a crustal type earthquake, magnitude 6.1. Not too many people dying, but $30 billion in damage for affecting the economy of the U.S. And then the following year, an earthquake in Japan happens in Kobe. Again, not a large earthquake. Kobe has a similar situation that we have, subduction earthquakes, crustal earthquakes. They were expecting the big subduction earthquake. A crustal earthquake happens closer to town, $200 billion of damage, okay? 5,000 people losing their lives. So then people started realizing that you not only have to protect lives, but you also have to protect property. So the concept of performance-based design started evolving as saying what level of performance you might want or what like to expect from the structure, okay? Of course, there is a financial implication of increasing the level of performance, right? It's like when you buy a car. You buy a cheap Japanese car or you buy a fancy European car that has all the bells and whistles, and like a Volvo, you have safety on that, and everybody believes that big safety, you pay for that, okay? That's performance-based, okay? You pay for the performance, and you expect good performance, yeah.
Right. So you are the director of the Earthquake Engineering Research Facility at UBC. Can you tell us about the kind of research you do there and how you model structures and simulate earthquakes in your lab?
Okay. In recent years, we have developed better knowledge about earthquakes by visiting sites and learning what had happened and bringing those lessons here. We have now tremendous tools to do simulations in fast computers, very fancy computer programs to do simulations. And we also have very nice tools in the laboratory to simulate earthquakes. Okay? And 30, 40 years ago, most of the earthquake simulation was done through pushing and pulling things, right? Now we have the ability to simulate real earthquakes through an earthquake simulator. We call that shake table. And one of the unique things that we have here in the laboratory is that we have several of these earthquake simulators. Okay, we have two large ones that allow us to put real models. A few years ago, we put a two-story house, full-scale model on that, and we shook it, and we learned a lot of how the houses here in the province are likely to perform in different earthquakes. Or we can build scale models of buildings or bridges and shake them in many directions as the earthquake happens. So this facility that we have at UBC here is very unique because it allows us to do this type of close simulations to earthquakes, right? We still cannot simulate the large ones that have large displacements of the ground, like that, what we have seen in countries like Taiwan, where you have 9 meters of vertical displacement and 3 meters of horizontal displacement. That's still too much, but we can model good-sized earthquakes and see what happens in models. So combining the experimental work on the shaking table plus analytical work, we learn a lot and we can improve our designs gearing towards this concept of performance-based design.
Right. And now some of your current research is looking at the seismic retrofit of schools in British Columbia, as well as some work on some of the monitoring the health of bridges in the province. Can you tell us about that as well?
Okay. Well, this is, again, tied up to knowledge that we are acquiring, right? And in the province, we have a number of schools that have been deemed to be high seismic risk. Okay, and that's been known since the 1980s, late 1980s, where the studies were started. But in those years, the process of identifying the buildings, school buildings that were at risk, and the province putting money to do the retrofit was very, very slow process. And it's a very expensive proposition. So over the years, the process was happening, but very slowly. And some families got concerned here, and they formed a group to push the government to speed up the process. So in 2004, we started working with them and the Association of Professional Engineers to assist the Ministry of Education in developing tools and techniques to assess which buildings were at highest risk and come out with technology to retrofit those using the best resources and making the best use of the money that was available. And that's a project that we have, and we have been working since 2005 in developing tools and guidelines so that the engineers can use and not be overly conservative, make use best use of knowledge that we have today about earthquakes and the materials as well, and optimize the use of that, recognize that buildings have certain intrinsic capacity to resist earthquakes, and just add things so that they could resist the earthquakes that we expect to have here. So that's the school retrofit project. And I have the privilege to work with some of the top structural engineers and geotechnical engineers in the province. So this is not just an effort from UBC, but it's an effort from the engineering community to assist society here in BC in ensuring that our school buildings are retrofitted. We still have a long ways to go.
Right. And as far as the bridges go?
The bridges is another interesting technology, right? Over the years, we have developed this concept, the community, that is called structural health monitoring. Okay, and the analogy is similar to what happens when you go to your doctor every year for your checkup, right? You go and you have your physical exam, and either you have too much weight or you have to do this, and you have questions, and then you have your tests done, etc. So the concept has been applied now to structures, right? Check the health of the structure. Of course, the structure doesn't talk back to you. So you have to find a way to tell the structure that needs help. And with that, we use technology that has been developed, very sophisticated sensors. We're using the internet to put the instruments on a bridge. Presently, we are installing instruments in the Second Narrows Bridge, and the Pitt River Bridge has been instrumented, the Massey Tunnel, and a few bridges, and also the new Portman Bridge that is being built is going to be instrumented and monitored here from UBC. So the technology that we have developed is that I can check the status of those bridges anywhere in the world, just connecting through the internet, and get the data of what is happening in the bridge at any time of the day due to traffic, or if there is an earthquake. We have tools and techniques to evaluate the data and communicate to the Ministry of Transportation of what we are seeing there, so they can make a decision of whether the bridge is safe to operate or not.
Right.
So this is pure state-of-the-art technology that has been developed through a number of years by the community, and we are putting our efforts in making this technology available to BC. Yeah.
And finally, I just want to ask you about the fact that in 1976, you were a survivor of a very devastating earthquake in your native country of Guatemala. What memories do you have of this event, and how has that experience influenced what you're doing today?
Okay, that's an interesting story. I can speak for days about that, but let me give you the short side of that. I was finishing university at that time, engineering school, and the earthquake happened at 3 in the morning. Now, Guatemala is a country where earthquakes happen all the time. Okay, so you're used to that. You're used to the tremors, and people know what to do. And similar to what happened in Chile, that's why people were able to cope with the earthquake, because they knew what to do. Okay. So I knew that I had to go out of the house and check everything, and then I went back to sleep at that, because it was like any earthquake, right? And then in the morning, I was working in the morning and going to school in the afternoon. I went to work, and then I start seeing the devastation that the earthquake caused, right? And it was a 7.8 magnitude. It killed about 25,000 people and destroyed a large part of the country. So to me, that was the motivation to study and say, why is this happening? Some buildings that were brand new were demolished, and started questioning why that happened. Okay, good engineers designed those buildings, and but they are on the ground. Okay, why? And that's what motivated me to study earthquakes, and this is why I'm here today.
Well, we're very privileged to have you at the university.
Thank you.
And thank you, Carlos. It's been such a pleasure.
I really enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
Great. I've just been speaking with Professor Carlos Ventura from the Department of Civil Engineering. He is also the director of the Earthquake Engineering Research Facility at UBC. Listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. I've had the pleasure of having Dr. Carlos Ventura on the show today. In 2 weeks, I will speak with Dr. Pascal Lavoie, who is a clinical assistant professor in the UBC Division of Neonatology. We will discuss some of his recent research on protecting premature babies who become sick from infections or other diseases after birth. If you would like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, please visit CITR.ca and please do check out our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for listening today.